He's an American icon who fought in World War II, gave you Martin and Lewis, Martha Ray, George Gobel, Tennessee Ernie Ford, Andy Williams, Fried Green Tomatoes, Spinal Tap, The Princess Bride, The Sure Thing, Stand By Me, The Declaration of Independence, People for the American Way, and a few TV shows.
Maybe you've heard of a couple of these.
All in the Family, Sanford and Son, Maude, Good Times, The Jeffersons, Hot L, Baltimore, One Day at a Time, Mary Harmon, Mary Harmon, The Dumplings, All's Fair, All the Glitters, Fernwood Tonight, America Tonight, Different Strokes, The Facts of Life, The Baxters, Archie Bunker's Place, Silver Spoons, Gloria, Square Pegs, a.k.a. Pablo, Who's the Boss, 227, Sunday Dinner, The Powers That Be, 704 Houser, Channel Umpteen and 3, One Day at a Time on Netflix.
All of the above with Norman Lear. It's all of the above with Norman Lear. What you do, you know that Norman Lear is just another version of you.
So, if we are rolling, this is all of the above. If we're not rolling, it's still all of the above with Norman Lear and sidekick and buddy and good friend and talker of talkers, Paul Hipp.
Hello, Norman.
Hello. What's your name again?
Hipp, Paul. H-I-P-P.
Hello, Paul.
At Paul Hipp. At the real Norman Lear. Is we never plug our social media.
No, I never do that. But, matter of fact, I'm hearing it at the real Norman Lear for the first time.
Or is it at the Norman Lear? Where's Michael? Is it at?
At the Norman Lear.
See, I fucked it up. All right, take two. And you're at the Norman Lear.
I'm at the Norman Lear and didn't even know it until today. But yeah. That's what I woke up to find.
We're so modern right now.
Yes. And to show how modern we are, we've got great guests.
Oh, yeah.
Great guests, and they're due any second now.
Should we say
as I said that, the door was opening, and Joe Mantegna was walking in.
Hey!
Followed by Kirsten. And here they are.
Hello.
Hello, Kirsten. Welcome. What's your last name, Kirsten?
Kirsten Vangsnes. It's one of those names.
No, Vangsnes.
Vangsnes. It's Norwegian.
Oh.
I'm half Norwegian, half Italian, but the Norwegian you can hear.
It is. I looked at it for 15 times in the course of the day and couldn't figure out how to pronounce it.
Me too.
Vangsnes.
Vangsnes.
Yeah. Do you speak any Norwegian?
No, I just know how to say ofta.
I know how to say tusen takk.
Hey, I know how to say Vangsnes. That's what I know in Norwegian.
How about Italian? You know any Italian?
I know how to say Montagna.
There you go. That's very good.
That's Italian.
Mm-hmm. That is Italian. Yeah.
Quanto si bella. That's my
question.
What do you think of that, Joe?
I
love it.
I don't know anybody I care about whose favorite country is not Italy.
That's especially if they eat for a living, you know.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's a World War II joke I'm reminded of. I think you have to probably live it at that time to know this joke. But what is the shortest book ever written? The title of the shortest book ever written, Italian War Heroes.
Oh, there we go.
Ah.
See,
No, Italian War Heroes.
Right. That's
because
true. We fought
it's
for the wrong
side. It's not about
wine.
It's not about love.
Yeah,
it's not
exactly.
About music. It's not about
We're
it's
too busy
about
making
war.
Out,
That's
eating,
true.
And listening
exactly.
to
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's true.
That could be interpreted different ways, though, that joke.
Yeah, I know. That's
no, tell me how.
Yeah. Well, just as an Italian joke.
If you know it's a joke.
No, it's true. You're absolutely true. Right. And we have to admit, we did fight initially for the wrong side.
Oops.
You know what I mean? Oops.
Oopsie.
But we switched over. That's what I loved about the book,
well,
Catch-22.
What's happening in America right now.
Yes, there we go.
Yeah. This guy actually does Mussolini.
I often think of Mussolini when I'm talking about Trump.
Yeah,
they were jokes.
I would say though that the one thing that I can appreciate about him is he single-handedly managed. It's like he's like the rock, and the bugs underneath the rock when you pick up the rock. So he single-handedly revealed. All of us are now suddenly aware of environmental problems, LGBT issues, racial issues, all these things that were problems. But he's so crazy about so many. Like you realize he's made us aware of so many things that are needed to be handled because he's so ineffective, you know, and selfish. It makes us all have to be selfless.
Yeah.
Because if you're not, it will collapse under its own weight. And democracy is something that must be fought for every generation. It's not a thing that's just exists.
Yeah. Well, it's pretty plain. There's a lot of problems.
Well, we're off
and we're going to solve them all.
Yeah, we're going to solve them all. Not today.
We're off that.
I thought we were going to do
so
it.
So we're gathered because Paul and I would be here in any event.
Yeah.
But Joe Mantegna is with us. And that isn't one of the names that everybody recognizes so easily. But the face that goes with that name is so recognizable. So, Joe, how many films have you done?
I don't know, Norman. I don't know. So, you know, it's funny when you first start out in your career, especially you start out in film, you start thinking, wow, I did a movie. Then you go, wow, I think I've actually done 10 movies.
Yeah.
And you know the number. And then you realize you've been in the business a long time when you get asked the question like that and you go, I don't know what the hell how many have done. I mean, you know, it's north of 100, but who cares? It's
north of 100 films. So those of you who are listening to this, the chances are more than good. They're great that you have seen this face again and again, would know it well. And Mr. Mantegna, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Kirsten, you work together.
Yes. We work on Criminal Minds together.
How does that come about?
I was lucky enough. I was a theater nerd who couldn't afford her $500 a month apartment. I got two lines as a co-star on this show, and because I was a theater nerd, I could do everything in one take. They kept me there. and then I was lucky enough to stay on the show, and then he came and classed up the joint in the most miraculous of ways, and they keep bringing me back. So he's a no-brainer, but I get to work with him. So he was in one of his movies he has done is my movie that I made called Kill Me Deadly. And I made a movie in Los Angeles. We shot it in Los Angeles. We Taft-Hartley'd everybody who wasn't union, and it was a period film, and we paid everybody a living wage. So everybody became SAG and WGA and all that stuff. And he was in my movie, which is a film noir spoof, and he was amazing in it. That's one
you remember
of his movies.
That film, Paul?
Which one was it?
It's called Kill Me Deadly. You probably haven't seen it,
but I spent the title.
Yeah, but I'll make sure you get a copy.
Kill Me Deadly. I kind of do remember that.
We spent $1 million on the movie.
You can talk a little bit lower.
Oh, sorry. I'm a theater girl. That's me.
You're using your theater voice.
I am.
Exactly. You're hitting the last row of the theater.
That's right.
I'm talking with my diaphragm. How dirty of me. it's a Steve Martin joke I just stole. We made this movie, me and my theater nerds, and Joe was in that. That was one of Joe's movies.
We're blessed to have her on Criminal Minds, I tell you that.
Criminal Minds is in its 13th concert.
Just finished their 13th season. Year, yeah.
Wow.
Our 299th episode.
Have you been with it since the beginning?
I have been. I was only not in episode 5.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Joe, you joined it in progress?
I joined it at the beginning of season 3, so I've done 11 years on the show now.
You're one of the smart movie stars who saw television, the switch to television early, because now they all want to get into TV and they're, you know.
Well, you know, I have two daughters, you know, I've had a great life. I feel very blessed. But, you know, early on when you're just basically doing films, you're traveling, you're going around. And I used to take the kids with me. My wife and kids, we travel. It was great. I have an older daughter with autism, which has always been, you know, it has its challenges as a family and continues to be, but it's fine. You know, everybody has a story. But there did come a point in my life when I realized, you know what, I'd like to be able to come home at night. I'd be able, ideally, you know, just live a life, work as close to 9 to 5 as you read about people doing in the real world, and come home every night and spend it with your family. And I've been able to do that now for, you know, 11 years and counting. And it's fantastic. And to work with the same group of people. I mean, they talk about creating a theater family. I have to tell you, Norman, I mean, you created the ultimate All in the Family. I mean, you're talking about a show where you have a family of actors who can just get along, love each other.
It's wonderful.
Get together with a crew, everybody in that group.
You know, I'm doing that again. You may not know right now. There's so much to watch. See, I say this because a lot of people don't know. But somebody came up with the idea of doing a Latino version of One Day at a Time.
Wow.
And we're going into our third season on Netflix.
That's right. Yeah. Yes.
One Day at a Time with Rita Moreno and Justina Machado.
Oh,
and,
great.
You know, just – but it's the family. The word family is
exactly,
what made me think
exactly
of
right.
They're just so lovable, huggable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is a wonderful thing. It's a great thing. I just did finish season 9 of a show I've been recurring on. I'm not a writer, but the middle. And it was so sad.
My daughter was on that a couple times.
Oh, was she? Oh,
yeah,
great.
My daughter Gia, she played the girlfriend of the older boy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Devin Levin. She played his character, Devin Levin, who was like this kind of, jock girlfriend of his, which was great.
Oh, cool.
Loved that show, though.
And the nicest people. But that family thing, when you know, the family kind of like breaks up, it's really sad.
Oh,
I mean, it's over and next, but you go and you're thinking, wow, this is... Well, my thought was, because I play a youth minister who plays guitar and sings, so that I get to write the songs. And so I had my conversation with the producers about what the songs will be about for this week's episode, you know, as I've done for 9 seasons. And when I hung up the phone, I thought, oh, that's sad. That's the last time we'll do that. And then just as quickly, the very next thought was, I'll never work again.
No, well.
But anyway, talk about that family. It really is a wonderful thing in show business, and we get to have. And you had how many families on TV at one time?
I don't know, 6 or several.
Yeah, six or several.
That's right.
Not only that, but those families taught us people that didn't really have great families how to be what a family could be.
The Norman Lear families.
Yeah. Oh my God! Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Oh, then there's the people working together. I mean, that's where.
Yeah. But I mean that beyond that, you had Maude and a crew.
Yes.
You had All in the Family and a crew. You know.
One Day at a Time and a crew, the Jeffersons, right. Good times.
And you dealt with what was really, these were what you would call comedies, but yet you dealt with such important social issues in all of them. I mean,
well, because they were the issues we were living with.
Yeah.
It wasn't in one house. It was in a house down the street or across the street or... We were only dealing with problems that everybody faced and lived through.
You say that as if it was easy, but nobody was doing that until you did it, right? It was Bewitched.
I'll never understand why. I mean, I never did anything else. I didn't do. I mean, even Mary Hartman. They were, you know. Anyway.
Anyway.
We're living with the same problems we were living with then. Nothing has changed. I think the only thing that every time there's a conversation about moving forward, I can think about in the LGBT area, we have moved so far forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I sat the other day with a couple, a man, a woman. She had been married to another woman who was black. And she is sitting there talking about, and there were a couple of white people. And she's talking about her wife.
Right.
That I had met many years before. And her husband is sitting there as she's talking about her wife. Now, this isn't even worth repeating, except that I'm stuck in my generation. And it's nothing to the average listener, I'm sure, today. What the hell am I? Like that's something.
Mm.
But in my generation, it awes me that, you know, that so much wonderful change has taken place.
Yeah. I'm a very strong supporter of our military, though, and I do hope we reverse that whole thing of, you know, disallowing gays in the military, because I think that's been
transgender.
That's what
Trump did for us.
Yeah, and I think that's something that I think, you know, I don't know. I don't quite get that, because I would imagine that there's some very people out there in our military that
there's a lot
doing
of
some very important work.
There are people that have served for their life that are going to be kicked out.
Yeah, and that I think there's something wrong there.
But you say you're a big supporter of our military, but do you know anybody who's not? I mean, really, as Americans, we pretty much support our military.
But what happens is a lot of times people like to, they become real supporters when you kind of need them. It's that whole kind of thing of, like, you know, when you have to unleash the dogs of war, then you're glad to have them. But then otherwise you almost want to put them aside and not worry about them. And you're kind of glad they're there, but you forget about them. And I think that, you know, we have to be we have to embrace these men and women who, when in time of crisis, are willing to put their lives on the line and actually give up their life so we can do things like this, do talk shows in the middle of Beverly Hills.
Yeah. Yeah, Norman fought so that we could do this podcast. And not have that to do it in German.
That was another time. World War II.
Sure. Were you Army?
I was in the Air Force.
Air Force, great.
I flew 52 missions with the 15th Air Force out of Foggia, Italy.
There you go.
Yeah. That's where I fell in love with Italy as a kid in the service.
When you're in the service and you're in Foggia and you're state, do you get to hang out, travel there. A bit? Do you get to go out and...
The picture that will come up is, I always used to say, this is me in Rome. I looked like this for 20 minutes in Rome one day.
Look at that.
Like a movie That's star.
It looks like Frank Sinatra in,
or something.
But from here to eternity.
When I grew up, which was only a few months ago, I said, why am I saying 20 minutes in Rome one day? I've said that all my life.
Yeah.
I looked like that, not for 20 minutes. That's where I looked.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It seemed like 20 minutes ago, though, right? I bet that in some ways.
In some ways.
Yeah.
Speaking of Frank Sinatra, how fun was it to play Dino?
Oh, well, ironically, just this past weekend.
Joe played Dean Martin.
I played Dean Martin in the movie The Rat Pack. But just this past weekend, Dean's daughter, Dina, did a celebrity roast. She's bringing back the celebrity roast.
Oh.
And they roasted me.
Yes, they
in
did.
Las Vegas. And Kirsten was gracious enough to be one of the roasters.
Did you roast Joe?
Oh, yeah.
There was a whole
it's hard to roast a real nice guy.
Give us one roast joke.
Oh, my God.
I said that we're so happy that he's working on Criminal Minds, playing the celebrated character Mandy Patinkin. that he recently stopped dyeing his hair, Clairol, I think it's called Wayne Newton Chestnut.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
That was great. That was one of the roles that I'm sorry it stopped. In other words, on our last day of shooting, I looked at Don Cheadle and Ray Liotta, who played, you know, Sammy Davis and Frank Sinatra, respectively. I said, boys, can't we keep this going? Is there a way we can just, you know, just wearing those clothes and, you know, being in that environment and that music and, you know, I just wanted to keep doing it, but it was a real thrill.
You guys could take that act on the road.
Oh, yeah. I want to do, like, let's do 6 months on the road. Come on. We'll all, you know.
Or at least in Branson or something, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that was my second job in the business was writing for Dean and Jerry.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
The Colgate Comedy Hour.
Right. I remember that.
Started with them. Jerry had seen a sketch Ed Simmons and I had written for Jack Haley, who had the Jack Haley Ford Star Review. That was my first job. He'd seen a sketch on there. Would never do it now. A sketch called, it was about two people who were nearsighted, couldn't find each other when they took their glasses off. And it was savage when you think about it now for people who had eye problems. You'd never do it, but we did it then. And Jerry wanted to do it, so we inherited the Colgate Comedy Hour.
Wait, so you could not do that joke now?
I wouldn't elect to.
You wouldn't elect to?
No, I imagine we could do it.
In some ways, I think we're getting a little too overly sensitive about things, though. It's almost like the list is almost longer what you can't do than what you can do.
Well, speaking as someone who is nearsighted with an astigmatism, we're quite violent. So you don't want to offend us.
Yes.
And get really
but
mad.
You would be able to laugh at that bit.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
As long as you had your glasses on and could see the TV.
As long as she could see who said the bit.
Then I'll punch you in the face.
The way the sketch went, the more terrible things we could think of that they could do because they couldn't see well. That's how you got the laughs. So it was ugly.
Now, I understand that Dino, he wasn't the whole drinker thing was just
an act.
You know,
he'd be up playing golf at 6 a.m.
Right. When Dean and Jerry split up, we were writing for them. No, we had stopped writing for them. But Ed Simmons was very close to Dean. Ed Simmons went to Dean and said, I don't want any money. I just want to help. You're going to be doing your own act now. I want to be your first writer. And I'm not asking for anything. So he wrote for Jerry, for Dean, for, you know, the first 100 jokes or whatever. But Dean, he said, he asked Dean, what are you thinking of in terms of your stand-up? And he said, what the hell was the name of the guy? Joe E. Lewis.
Joe E. Lewis.
He said, Joe E. Lewis, post time, did, you know, made a character out of being a drinker, and he isn't around to do that now. I want to take that on. I want to be.
Wow.
So Dean never was a, I mean, he drank.
Yeah. Right.
But he wasn't a big drinker.
No, we had a scene in the movie, The Rat Pack, where you see me off stage and I actually took a glass and a bottle of apple juice.
Yeah.
You see me pouring apple juice in the glass and then walking out and basically saying, you know, oh, how do all these people get in my room? You know, and it's like, and we got that from doing the research that sometimes, you know, just like you said, he wanted to create that character and it was fine. But he drank at his own time, not in front of a crowd.
You know, he would come in when we were in rehearsal above the Paramount Catering on West 46th Street. Dean some mornings would come in so funny, so funny. There were a number of times when Jerry would curl up in the corner on the floor, like in a fetal position. And Miv Levy, his doctor in Beverly Hills, was flying in. That happened a number of times, and it never was spoken aloud, but Ed and I always knew he couldn't handle those days when Dean was just... Jerry had to go,
Oh, he wouldn't let me funny.
And Dean was just plain hilarious.
Right.
His knuckles, I used to think this all the time, his knuckles were funny. His earlobes were funny. He was funny.
Yeah. From Steubenville, he was a genuine tough guy.
Yeah, he was.
Right?
Yeah,
from Steubenville, Ohio.
Steubenville, Ohio. They still have a day for him every year in Steubenville where they honor him. You know, Dean Martin.
Dean Martin Day.
And his daughter, Dina, usually shows up for that, and they do a whole thing.
And then I'm going to talk about Dean the whole time, but I love on his show that he had, what, in the late 60s into the 70s, Dean Martin show, he wouldn't show up.
Right.
Except he'd show up to watch the run-through.
Right.
And then he would go on and do it.
He wouldn't rehearse.
He never knew what was going on.
No. Like, I think that bit when they had to, where we jumped on a piano and collapsed, he didn't know that was going to happen because they didn't rehearse it. And they just put that in there. So when he jumps up and the thing collapses, like, oh, my God.
What's another favorite role that you've done? A lot of The Godfather, the Mammoth stuff that you've done.
Yeah, I've been blessed, you know. My favorite role is what I'm doing right now. I mean, I've been doing this Criminal Minds now 11 years, and I'm working with people I love, and it's all great. Like I say, it's always the next thing, too.
Yeah.
You know, you hope that the next thing's going to be great. But this one's been the longest run. I've done Fat Tony on The Simpsons for 27 years now. That's my longest running role.
But you and Kirsten have something else on your mind also. What's happening now with
children? Today, May 25th is National Children Disappearance Awareness Week, and I am butchering that, but the order of that. But the point of it is to make everybody aware and cognizant of the important – I think we all can agree that missing children is a bad thing. So, WeTV is doing programming to sort of spotlight this awareness of missing children, and it's going to start on. It's going to be every Saturday and Monday, and they're doing a lot of Criminal Minds marathons during that time, and.
There's going to be episodes that will feature that. In other words, that will play up the point of, you know, the problem of missing children. And that's one aspect of our show that I think has helped give us the longevity in that our show, besides being a drama, there's an educational aspect to it. In other words,
is it about missing children?
Well, there are episodes within we've done 299 episodes.
Yeah.
That's how we ended our season this year with number 299. Within those 299, there is a cross-section of episodes that – explicitly, deals with missing, exploited children. And by watching our program, if nothing else, you also can learn something from it. Like, okay, how can we avoid this? How did this happen? Can we learn something from this? And I think our writers have made a conscious effort to, whenever possible, when we create a problem or show how the problem exists, is there an answer to this? Is there a solution to this? Is there something we can avoid? Because we represent a real organization. We are the behavior analysis unit of the FBI, and they really do exist. And we have to kind of
portray
them.
Joe, what are the – if you know, and Kirsten, what are the stats? What are the statistics about missing children? How much of that can we expect in an average year?
I think that my understanding – I don't have numbers, you know – on me just because I'm terrible with numbers, and even if someone had given me numbers, I'd give you the wrong numbers. But I do think that people are being more, I think we had this period of time where, you know, the milk carton thing happened, and now it's moved on. Instead of just vigilance, it's now like more common sense, which I think is one of the things that our show tries to do is offer some common senseness, because there are certain things that really affect the most vulnerable people in our society, like human trafficking that happens to kids so much. And that's something that our show has featured, certainly when we do these episodes. I think, but I don't have
800,000 children are reported missing each year.
If only we had a tiny computer.
There you go.
Yes.
Well, I was going to say.
Yeah, what Mr. Hip did was take out a cell phone.
Yeah.
Why didn't he?
He was doing math.
Why couldn't I have
known
something for once?
No, I meant he was doing math. You were doing math.
I was doing math. Yeah, this is my moment, Norman. Yeah. 800,000. Wow. I knew that because I care.
Wow.
No, that's incredible.
Well, you think about it. If you just watch the local news every day, there's always some, and so-and-so's missing, and so-and-so's missing. So you multiply that times every town and every city in the country and around the world even, it's going to come up with numbers like that.
I am shocked by that, and I did use my phone, I will admit it. But that is 800,000.
Right.
That shocks me. I would not, if you had asked me, I would never have guessed so high.
And, you know,
that's astounding.
A couple hundred thousand, 203,000 kidnapped by family members. Well, that's amazing that you're doing that. So that'll be on Saturdays
and Mondays on WeTV.
On WeTV, all
through the spring,
right?
And where's the show
regularly on CBS?
Normally on CBS. Yeah, we've been on CBS now 13 years, and looking forward to season 14.
At what time of day and which day?
We usually come on Wednesday nights. Now 10 o'clock Eastern time. And we used to be on at 9 o'clock. Now we're on at 10 o'clock and every Wednesday. And then we're on syndication on a few different stations and WeTV included.
Residuals.
Yeah, it's all good. It's all good. Yeah, thank God for that.
Well, Joe and I did a movie together. Did you know that, Norman?
More Dogs Than Bones.
More Dogs Than Bones. We played assassins.
Right, with Whoopi Goldberg and who else was in that?
Yeah, Whoopi Goldberg, Peter Coyote.
That's right. Peter was in it.
Was in that Mercedes Rule.
And there was a big dog. Do you remember that big dog?
Yeah, I do.
I remember there was a big dog.
Oh, you know, you know who else was in it? It was Debbie Mazar.
Oh, Debbie Mazar. Who? It's funny. You know, I ran into Sean Penn. In the elevator, just as he was leaving here, just tonight, and I worked with his wife at the time, Madonna, on Broadway when we did play Speed the Plow, back then. And you mentioned Debbie Mazar. Debbie at the time was Madonna's hairdresser, and that's what she was doing at the time. And I remember on Wednesday between shows, between matinee and evening show, Debbie would come into my dressing room and give me a little trim. I'd say, "So Debbie, what are you up to?" You know, and she goes, "You know, Joe, I think I might go into acting." You know, she'd be cutting my hair, and I'm thinking to myself, "Oh yeah, everybody wants to be an actor." Okay, so I say, "Yeah, Debbie, a little more on the side here." Okay, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then, of course, she goes on and has a wonderful career as an actress, and I love her to death. And so, I mean, it was like, I mean, I knew her as you know, Madonna's barber, and now she went on to, you know, to create a career for herself.
Yeah, very, very good career.
Speaking of small worlds, didn't Madonna have something to do in her early life with Sean Penn?
Yeah, they were married.
Yeah, they were married at the time when I did Speed the Plow.
They were married,
and that's how you know, I got to know Sean back then. So it was great. We hadn't seen each other in a long time.
Yeah.
So we just saw each other downstairs.
So. And just so the listeners know, that was last week's episode. It took Sean a week to get to the elevator. I mean, does he move slow or does? Well, he's an author now.
God bless him.
He had a tent. I did see a
tent. He had a tent.
Oh, backpack.
Right. Yeah. So he's been living in the building.
Oh, yeah. Show them the title of that book.
This is Sean's new book, Bob Honey, Who Just Do Stuff.
Okay. All right.
I recommend it.
Wait a minute. I wrote a book with that same title. No, I don't know.
What are the odds?
Yeah, what are the odds?
You know, when we did our movie, you know, I'm always so fortunate to work. I worked with some great actors, and you are certainly one of the great ones. So I always watch people. I'm always watching. I think it's important for actors to be aware, watch everything that's going on. And I watched you, and we had some fun
making this
because we were two bungling assassins.
Yeah, it was a comedy.
We were supposed to assassinate the guy in apartment number 9, but the thing fell off. The number fell, and it turned into we were supposed to go to 6, but we went to 9 because the number – anyway. Joe gets shot with a tranquilizer dart during the proceedings. Right. And I remember for a few days, you had to be tranquilized. Right. You had to play this thing. And I watched you have fun with this. And I watched you and I thought, wow. Because, see, if you get shot with a tranquilizer dart, what would you do? Yeah, how do you play that? Exactly. What do you do? And I'm watching Joe doing the heavy lifting right. that these days. Don't you know, I did this movie that will go nameless because it's not very good. A few years later, and I got shot with a tranquilizer dart, and I just remember thinking, Joe Montaigne, Joe Montaigne, Joe, and I just basically aped what you did. Great, so
good
thank
research.
You, Joe.
My pleasure.
He's like that, though, you know, because he's our number one guy in the call sheet, and, you know, everybody sort of follows along with that. And when you have the nicest, most decent, most hardworking, on time, but still gritty, still like yeah. a tough guy, still you're scared yeah, of him. Yeah. It's sure. the best thing in the world. And I remember one of the first day I worked with him, he came up to me and he was like, do you want to run lines? And I was like, what angel came from heaven? That's just Joe Mantegna is asking me if we, yes. And we ran lines and the guy before you who shall remain nameless, but his name rhymes with Randy Rorinkin. I remember he would say, do you want to run lines? And then he would improvise right after in the lines for 25 minutes. So although I love improvising.
Improvise on TV?
Oh, like, well, not live TV, but yeah. I mean, like, you know, in a very strange way that didn't necessarily follow the plot. And God love him. But it was so great to he's just such a, you're just such a joy. You're a dreamy actor. You're dreamy to watch.
I love
you.
He yelled at me. I love you.
It's just true.
He yelled at me and hit me a lot. It's not my
he shares
experience.
His snacks.
Oh, that was my angry years.
Know.
That must have been my angry years.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wait, we've gotten tangled up here. Oh, there we go.
That's why nobody has heard me for this hour.
Norman was tied up in the headphone cable. No. Wait,
we never actually worked together. Closest
we got close to it when you had your company and I was doing a play, Bleacher Bums, here in Los Angeles. It ran about 10 years at the small theater in Century uh-huh. City. And your company, some of the guys who worked in your company, they came and saw it. And I wound up doing an episode of Archie Bunker's Place. And they asked myself and one of the other guys was in a play with me that we uh-huh. from the original cast of Bleacher Bums. We came up with hopefully some pilot ideas that maybe you guys would have done. We wound up not doing anything, but it was just a great experience just being around that kind of you guys are. I mean, that was a top of the ladder in terms of
it was a creative group. Talk about family again.
Yeah,
it was a great family of people. We had a wonderful time.
Yeah,
wonderful time. But I saw on a. List of your credits, Archie Bunker, because I had nothing to do with Archie Bunker's Place. That was all Carol.
But it still came out. It was out of that whole world. Yeah. I mean, out of that group.
Yeah, no, it was made among all the other shows.
Right.
Oh, Carol O'Connor and Archie Bunker's Place.
I got to know Carol pretty well, too, which was great. You know, it was, he confided in me his whole thing about his fondness, talking about Italy, his fondness for Italy and the fact that his son, Ugo, had been adopted in Italy and all that, and he had that kind of that attachment to that country, which was very interesting.
When he was in Rome.
Uh-huh.
When CBS said they picked up the pilot, and I called him in Rome, and he needed... I mean, to get on a plane and come home from Rome, boy, did he need proof that this show was picked up. He couldn't believe he had to come home.
Right, right. He told me an interesting story. He says he says, I don't believe in this stuff about reincarnation and all that. It's not like I believe in all that. He says, but I really think at some time in my life, I was a former somebody who was Italian in Italy. And he says, the reason I believe that, he says, when I was there, I was there doing a movie or whatever it was. He was walking down the street, and his tour bus pulled up, and the tour bus was lost. They were looking for something. You know, it was an Italian tour bus driver, so it makes sense that he was lost. So the guy sticks his head out the window and yells to Carol, "Hey, do you know where the such and such place is?" And Carol says, "I gave the guy explicit directions on how to get there." And they said, "Thank you." And then the guy left. And as the bus pulled away, Carol thought to himself, "Wait a minute. I don't know what the hell I just told this person. I have no idea where this place is." And so he went and followed his own directions to what he just told the guy.
Oh.
And it took him right to that spot.
Amazing.
And he said to himself, he says he had his hair stood up on the back of his neck. He says, I had this revelation that I only knew this because in some past life I lived here. I lived here in Rome and I know this city. But yet I had no idea where this place was until this moment. And he really believed that. And then he says that was part of the reason when he adopted his son, Ugo, and it became this whole kind of connection to that country. Mm. Oh, God bless.
I remember when he lost that son. Oh, he never got over that.
No, he never did.
He never got over that.
No.
Well, Carol O'Connor is a good Italian name.
Yeah, Carol O'Connor, yes. O'Connorino, maybe. Might have shortened it.
O'Connor. Wow. What,
do you have a favorite role you played, Joe?
I don't know. I've been very blessed. There's been tons of them, from like I said, from Dean Martin to what I'm doing right now to the stuff I've done for Mamet, stuff I've done. You know, I was able to be in one of The Godfathers, which is kind of monumental just to be in a trilogy of movies. I mean,
the underrated Godfather 3.
Yeah, Godfather 3. I mean, so I've been able to do comedy, tragedy, plays, theater, television,
a lot
movies.
Of theater.
Yeah, a lot of theater. I did theater for. It's funny when I was lucky enough to win a Tony Award back in '84 for Glengarry Glenn Ross. And I remember when they would interview me for the play, the original play of Glengarry Glenn Ross on Broadway, the original production.
Yeah, I remember.
And I remember when I won the Tony, I got an interview the next day, and they says, "What does it feel like to win the Tony?" And at that point, I'd only done theater starting from 1969 to '84. They said, "What's it like to win the Tony Award?" I said, "You know what it's like? It's like winning the lottery, but I've bought 15 years worth of tickets."
Yeah.
And so it's that. So it's all been great. Just been a great, great ride. I have no complaints. And then here they have to work with somebody like Kirsten, who also is a theater person, who's just – she lives for that. She breathes it. Her theater company – Theater of Note has just been such a this wonderful theater group here in Los Angeles, and they're so imaginative, and they create these new works, and she's done these one woman shows that she's done, and besides that, being a writer for that company, I can relate to that. Those small little theater companies that you've come from the troupe of writers back in the day. If it ain't on the page, it ain't on the stage. And she is a perfect example of somebody who follows that. So
I'm blushing. You can't see it on the radio.
I think the way the Tonys are concerned, the important thing is the nomination.
No, you know what?
I didn't win. I was nominated, but I didn't win. That's
but you know what? But you know what?
No, the win is the important thing.
No, but Paul, I'm going to tell you, I was more moved by the nomination than by the win. And I'll tell you why. Because when you do come from theater, it's like something you know, I remember watching the Tony Awards as an acting student and stuff and thinking, wow, isn't that cool? Look at that. Somebody who actually won a Tony Award for this play. Mm. And I'll never forget, I'm in New York. The play had been running for a while, and it was like on a Sunday afternoon. The doorbell rang, and we were on a fifth floor walk-up on the Upper West Side. And my wife buzzed the person in, and they come up the stairs, and there was a knock on the door. And I opened the door, and there was a guy just standing there. And I was in my pajamas still. It was like noon on Sunday. It was a lazy day. And he had a little shopping bag. I'll never forget it. It was a little shopping bag. And on the shopping bag was the Tony emblem on the shopping bag. And all he said was, he goes, "Are you Joe Mantegna?" I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "You know, the Antoinette Perry Awards would just like to let you know you've just been nominated for a Tony Award." And they handed me that little shopping bag. And inside was this handwritten scroll thing that said you have been nominated. Well, you know, if you've got a nomination. And that was that, you know, something grabs you because all of a sudden you flash back to doing plays as a, you know, in high school and stuff. And here is them telling you, here is it. You know, not that awards, you know, it is what it is. Look,
it's nice.
It's just that affirmation of like maybe – yeah. Maybe you do got. Maybe you do belong in this career. Right? Maybe you'll do a play after this.
Yeah, right,
you know?
Exactly.
And of course, winning was great, but I'll never forget that moment. That moment was to me, that was more.
That's really nice.
Because anybody could have won, and you still would have been. What's the difference? That's like saying, what's the best piece of art here? That one or that one? It's somebody's opinion. Mm. But they put you at least in that category. It's like playing baseball. You're in the major leagues now, kid.
You get up the bat.
You know, it's the matter who gets the highest batting average that year. Doesn't matter. You're in the majors.
Now, was that your first experience with had you and Mamet worked together before that?
Well, yeah, Mamet and I'd worked together in Chicago.
Oh, that's right, of course.
And that's what led to that. Thank God.
So where did you guys meet? How did you?
Well, we met in Chicago because I was working with a theater company called the Organic Theater Company out of Chicago, and he had his own theater company name escapes me, his theater, St. Nicholas, a St. Nicholas theater company he had. And he saw me do a play at the Organic. Mm. And I remember I ran into him on the streets of Chicago. And I didn't know who he was. And he comes up to me and goes, oh, my name is David Mamet. I'm a playwright. Just want to let you know I saw you in blah, 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 whatever show it was. He says, I really think you're really good. Someday I'd love you to do one of my plays. And I'm thinking, yeah, great. Who are you? You do one of your plays. You know, what are you, Arthur Miller? I don't know. Okay. all right, whatever.
Turns out kind of.
Turns out kind of, yeah. And he is such a – I mean, God bless him. I love the guy to death because what happened is with Glengarry is he had already now made a name for himself with Sexual Perversity in Chicago and Life in the Theater. He had done these in New York at this point. So he was starting getting a name in New York. Now he's got this new play, Glengarry Glen Ross. The producers want to cast big stars. So they offered it first, from what I recall, to Pacino for the role to do the Broadway show. He turned it down. He was busy. They offered it next to De Niro. He turned it down because he was busy. And God bless David Mamet. He told the producers, he says, look, I get the third pick. We're not going to go down the list of every Italian actor in Hollywood or Broadway or whatever it may be. I want the guy I want to use. And I got chosen. And so we were all nobodies. That original cast, one of the last times on Broadway we had, the whole cast was like under the title. Because there was no stars. We were all nobodies. But the show went on to win the Pulitzer Prize. Yeah. I went on to win the Tony Award. It was a dream come true. And so I'm forever grateful for Dave for having that kind of moxie and faith in us to be able to say, you know what, we don't need a name over the title. Let's just go for it and let the play speak for itself. Just get the actors I want to use.
Directed that? Do you remember?
It was Gregory Mosher directed that original production.
That's some iconic stuff right there. That's theater history.
Yeah, no, it changed my life. That's for sure.
And then the films with Mamet, right? You did Homicide.
I did the House of Games was the first one. Then I did Things Change with Don Ameche. Then I did Homicide
Don Ameche.
Don Ameche, the great Don Ameche.
Oh my God, remember Don Ameche?
He was the best. We used to call him Old Hollywood. Uh-huh. I loved him to death.
He was iconic. I mean, there was only one Don Ameche.
Absolutely. There's a line in Godfather 3 that I kind of ad-libbed, and Coppola liked it, and he kept it in the movie. Because I'd already done the movie with Don Ameche, and we'd become dear friends. And so I'm playing this character, Joey Zaza. And we're having this in Godfather 3, and they're throwing this parade in Little Italy to honor Meucci, who the Italians believe invented the telephone.
You know? Is that right?
Oh, yeah. Italians think that Meucci invented the debate. Is it Alexander Graham Bell? The Americans think this. The Italians think it was Meucci. So we're having this Meucci parade. And Joey Zaza, my character, is throwing this parade. So they have a scene where we're doing a rehearsal in Little Italy in New York. And they have all these guys pretending to be, news guys interviewing me, saying, Mr. Zaza, you know, what do you think about this Meucci parade? And so I'm ad-libbing this bit because Coppola just said, you're doing an interview. Just ad-lib your responses. So the one guy says, what do you think about this? I said, Italians are great people. We've got Meucci, who invented the telephone. We have Don Ameche, who played the guy they think invented the telephone. Because he had played, Alexander Graham Bell movie.
Right.
And thank God Coppola said, keep that in. When we shoot it, keep that line in. And so I did. And then I remember the movie opened on Christmas Day that year. And that night, on Christmas night, I get a phone call. We're in our apartment in New York, my wife and I. And I get a phone call, and it was Don Ameche. And I hear the voice, Joe, with that great voice of his, it's Don. I was at the theater today, movies, and we saw Godfather 3. I'm sure you had something to do with that line. And I want to thank you very much for that.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So that was my way to immortalize Don Ameche in the Godfather trilogy.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
I've always wondered. The Mamet stuff. Go and we'll be done with that. But the language, the rhythms.
Mm-hmm.
Now, was that something you guys worked on together? Was that something that he had? Did you have to come to that? Did you work it out together?
Well, a lot of people don't realize is Mamet writes in iambic pentameter.
Yeah.
And so, but it's one of those things. He doesn't tell you that, or you don't debate that or talk about it, or maybe you do, but thank God I'm being from Chicago and growing up, you know, he grew up on the South Side, I grew up on the West Side. We didn't have to do a lot of shorthand to kind of understand. Right. I look at his stuff and I say to myself, yeah, I think I kind of talk like that anyway.
Yeah.
And so, you know.
Not easy to make work for, but everybody.
But as it's turned out, we've known each other for, you know, going on almost 50 years now. And during that time, we've never really talked about method or how to do it or whatever. It's like, you know, he does what he does, I do what I do, and it seemed to, we seem to meet somewhere in the middle, and it's worked out. So,
what's his most recent effort?
Well, he's been writing novels recently, and he just finished this one about Chicago. It's called Chicago. Just called Chicago, and it's all about the Prohibition in Chicago. Mm. And that's just can't come out. That's what he's so prolific. I mean, he writes plays, he writes screenplays, he writes novels, he writes you know, he essays. Yeah. He's quite a guy.
You get back to Chicago much?
Do I? When I'm going back next. Well, in June, to throw out the first pitch and sing the seventh for the Cubs, as I do every year.
Oh, so, great.
Yeah, I get there when I can. I mean, it's still, my heart's still, you know, when I open my mouth, nobody thinks I'm from, like, London. Or, you know, they get it.
Right.
There's
nothing like Wrigley.
No, nothing like Wrigley. Fenway, I guess, would be right in there with it, but yeah, the old ballparks. Exactly.
So season 13, you're in season 13 now.
Yeah, we just finished the finale.
Just finished.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you're picked up for 14, 15?
Not yet. We're not picked up.
Who created the show?
Jeff Davis.
Jeff Davis.
And then it was a show run by Ed Bernero for a while. And now Erica Messer has been leading our ship for a while. And she's great. But right now I think we're all in a, you know, we're all doing our other life stuffs because we have a bit of a break. Until they bring us back.
On our hiatus, and yeah.
You were picked up for next year?
Not yet.
Well, not the official one, but I think we're in pretty good shape. I mean, they let us do an incredible cliffhanger, which put her character in extreme kind of danger. So my feeling is if they don't let us finish that out, there's going to be we have fans all over the world, and I think there'll be a mass revolt, like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
You know,
after 13 years, you would like to think they would give us a little heads up and say, you know what, you guys got one more season to go.
Yeah.
Wrap it up.
And you know,
that'll happen when it happens.
If you get season 14, that's when you can buy a house.
Yeah.
That is yeah.
Yeah, or two.
We all know those actors that like get a show, buy the house,
right?
First season, and the show gets canceled.
Second season, you rent it out. Exactly. You live in a tent in the backyard.
Have you ever wished to direct, Joe?
I'm sorry?
He does. He directs.
I've directed usually two per season over the course of our last few seasons, and I've enjoyed that a lot.
And you like it?
I do. I do.
He's great.
Well, I enjoy it. Well, like I said, it took, you know, I've been at it a long time. You and I, we're not the two youngest guys in the room, Norman, you've got some experience.
I'm among the youngest, but I can't.
Can I just mention that we have something in common with Joe? A love of cigars. Did we mention that yet?
We talked about it.
Off the air, we talked about it.
Right. Yeah, I was one of the original. Norman will appreciate this, that when they started the Grand Havana Room here in Los Angeles, the first five members were myself, Joe Pantoliano, Dennis Franz, Andy Garcia, and Milton Berle.
That's a good table right there.
And there's a picture of us inside of the place when it's under construction, so it's still like cement in the air, and you know, there's no decorations or anything, and we're standing there, and then we all had our pick of our lockers. So if you go in there now, and it's been in existence now for, I guess, well over 25 years now, and it's a great club, and you see our lockers are right at eye level. You know, you don't have to. Some lockers, you got to get up on a ladder to get it.
Eye level's important.
Eye level's important because that was first pick. So we have the first. You can walk right in and, you know, grab a cigar. And I don't smoke a lot of cigars, but I'll do at least, as you know, one or. I'm not like George Burns, who would always have one in his mouth, but one or two a week, two even.
Frances Lear, my second wife, and I were married in Las Vegas, and the evening we were married was a Friday evening. Milton Berle was playing. And we went to dinner, the two of us, to see Milton Berle, and I took her backstage afterwards. And I was surprised at how small the dressing room was. But we were standing in the dressing room. She was standing because she couldn't sit, and he had asked us both to sit, and she said, go ahead, you sit. Anyway, I somehow was sitting with him, and she was standing. And he said, Norman, you smoke cigars, don't you? I said, yeah. He said, Schwartz! Schwartz! He screamed.
Really?
The Yiddish for black.
Right.
And his black valet came in. Oof. He said, Mr. Lear likes cigars. And he reached. Milton's jacket was hanging. Milton is sitting here. His jacket is hanging there within inches of him. The guy reaches into the inside pocket and pulls out a cigar.
Yeah.
And hands me the cigar.
Mm. Well, you know, Milton.
And
wow.
Francis Lear went nuts.
You may know that Milton actually owned John F. Kennedy's humidor. That when they,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, because what had happened is he had given it as a gift to Kennedy, you know, at one time, you know, because compared to that Jack Kennedy liked cigars.
H. Upman's.
So, he gave Kennedy a humidor and had it engraved to, you know, to JFK and you know, from Milton Berle.
Yeah.
And then I guess after Kennedy died or whatever, he was able to get the...
Got it back.
Got it back. And
did Francis Lear say anything about in the room at the time?
No.
Yeah.
No, because I, you know, I could have reached her and touched her, and I might have done
Ixnay on the, yeah.
But, yeah.
What did he smoke? What do you remember what Milton Berle smoked? What kind of...
He would smoke any cigar he can get his hands on. Because I remember Joe Pantoliano complaining that when we took the picture, Joe brought a whole bunch of, like, really good cigars for the shoot in case we needed them. So he had them laid out in a humidor. And so they had the humidor laying there. And the photographer says, why don't you all take a cigar for the photo? So we all took one cigar from Joe's humidor for the photo. Milton reached in and grabbed, I remember, a whole handful, stuck them in his pocket.
Oh, my
God. And then
God.
Lit the bad? One. And then, see you later, fellas, you know. So I guess Milton would, you know, he may have had a favorite, but I think his favorite was, like, you know, somebody else's cigar.
Yeah, that's a good brand.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, how do we do? We're...
Well, this is fun,
behind,
man.
Behind the window sits somebody with his hand on a dial and his eye on a clock. And his eye on a clock suggests we've reached...
Has it been wow. It's gone fast.
This is when you're enjoying yourself and the conversation is as good as this. This is what happens.
So let's remind them of the show on Wii. It's on...
WeTV,
Criminal Minds.
Criminal Minds on WeTV.
It's going to be on Saturdays and Mondays. There's going to be all kinds of programming that is going to highlight
disappearing
stuff, including
children.
Criminal Minds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you can check the schedule on WeTV because I think we're even aired on other nights of theirs as well. But,
yeah.
But those are...
Well, it's great of you to be doing that. Even greater that you stopped by here to do this. Yeah.
Always great to
meet us.
Great to see you.
This was wonderful.
Somebody I worked with and an icon from television like you, Norman.
Well, it's great to see you. You're more than an icon. You're, it's as if there's been a big picture of you in my home all these years. And great to meet you, Kirsten.
Such a pleasure.
Yeah, nice.
This has been all of the above. Thank you.
What does it mean, this life, this day and night?
So I'm Norman Lear, and you can find me, should you wish to hunt me down... You can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at The Norman Lear.
And you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Paul Itt.
And life is good, and space and time. Give me some of yours, I'll give you some of mine.
Podcast One Sports would like to congratulate Dan Patrick for his hard-earned Emmy nomination at this year's Sports Emmy Awards. With A-list guests from the world of sports, Dan Patrick brings you the inside scoop with a dose of humor.
People are going to bet on that game because they have to have a reason to watch that game.
Congratulations, Dan, and thank you for another year of the finest sportscasting around.
This guy's got it.
Check out the Dan Patrick Show every weekday on Podcast One Sports and Apple Podcasts, and remember to rate and review.